there, everybody. It is Thursday, October 24th, 2013, and you are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us an email. Send it on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is This Show Is So Gay. And, of course, go to the Facebook. Like us there, because we sure as heck like you. What an amazing show we have for you this week. We must get started with our first guest. Chris Hermans is the executive director of the Pride Foundation, an organization that has as its mission to inspire a culture of generosity that connects and strengthens Northwest organizations, leaders, and students who are creating lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer equality. Pride Foundation is the Northwest leader in bringing people, ideas, and resources together to strengthen community and ignite change that advances LGBTQ equality. But Chris is taking a break from all that to spend some time with us. Chris, welcome to The Show Is So Gay.
Thank you, Ken. I'm very honored to be with you tonight.
It is our pleasure to have you. We have so much to discuss. Are you ready?
Absolutely.
Well, we will start with you. Before we even get to the Pride Foundation, we have to talk about you. I am reading you are a native, what do we call them, Wisconsinite?
That's correct.
Look at that. I didn't even look that one up.
Or cheesehead for short.
I'm not allowed to say that, though. That's one of those things that you're allowed to say, but I'm not, right?
Fair.
Okay. Tell me about Wisconsin. It's one of those places I've never been. I know nothing about Wisconsin.
Well, it's a great state, and in fact, it reminds me a lot of the Northwest, and it has a very strong tradition of social justice and progressive-minded people.
Nice.
And right now, it's in a very difficult place with the current political leadership, and we're seeing, a complete attack on basic fundamental rights, not only for LGBT people, but for other people who have been historically disenfranchised. So it's kind of, I have a very, on some level, I'm happy I'm 2,000 miles away now here in Seattle, but I stay very close to, of course, all my family still there. I watch the Green Bay Packers and cheer for the Milwaukee Brewers and my first love, the Wisconsin Badgers. And, it's really, I think, Wisconsin and what's going on locally is a very interesting kind of bellwether for what we see across the country in a number of states around LGBT equality.
Two important questions that come to mind. One, what are the Wisconsin Badgers?
The University of Wisconsin.
I had no idea.
The mascot is a badger.
That's one of those that my mom is going to send me an angry email. Why didn't you know that? And then more
exactly.
Importantly, I'm moving past it, Chris. More importantly, question number two, have you ever worn one of those cheese things on your head?
Of course I have.
Are there pictures on Facebook?
No, not at all. There are some things, you just don't share on Facebook. And more people are learning that lesson. But I can proudly say that I am a shareholder in the Green Bay Packers.
Oh, we're going to get to that. We're not even there yet.
Okay.
That's just like a tip of the hand, but we'll get there.
And do let me know when your mom contacts you, because I'd be happy to have a conversation.
It will be before we're done talking, Chris. Don't you worry. She knows. She always knows. Especially because she's the one, and I probably shouldn't say this out loud, when I win the NCAA draft every year, it's because my mom filled it out. So I just want to put that out there. But
fantastic.
Who's listening? Now, you left Wisconsin, and you went to my homeland of the past 6-7 years. You went to New England for a spell.
I did. Yeah, it was great. I was, had the very unique opportunity to work in adult education, adult literacy work, and it was at a time when Governor Dukakis had this quasi-public-private partnership around eradicating adult illiteracy, thinking that basic education was a fundamental right, but also in terms of economic security and being able to take full advantage of the opportunities that people needed a grounding of education. And so I did that work for a few years before I went to graduate school. And then I just got lucky and landed in Providence, Rhode Island, worked at Brown University for a number of years before going on to the Rhode Island Community Foundation.
Now, there you worked for the Rhode Island Foundation, and there you created, tell everyone about Equity Action.
Yes, it's a LGBT-focused fund in a mainstream community foundation, and its charter is really to invest in organizations and leaders that are supporting and expanding opportunities for LGBT people in Rhode Island. And it's an endowed fund. I believe it might be the largest endowed fund in a mainstream community foundation now, and has a long legacy of supporting youth development, elder services, research, community assessments, and also worked on some of the marriage equality efforts.
Nice. Now, again, you've worked for the National Center for Lesbian Rights. You've worked with the Equity Action Fund. You've worked for the Women's Fund of Rhode Island. Why this type of work for you, Chris? What is it about you that says, you know, I just need to immerse myself in this social justice work?
It's a good question. I think, you know, it goes back to your original question about what's Wisconsin like. I mean, I think, you know, I grew up with a family and in a community where you had a concern for one another and you did something about it. And I just was blessed with mentors and other family members who continued to support that passion of mine. And, you know, doing LGBT equality work was never work that I, you know, imagined doing. And I just got lucky that I continued to find avenues and outlets for the passion and get paid to do it. And so I recognize I live a very blessed life right now in being able to do this work on a regional level and, you know, after working on it on a national level with the National Center for Lesbian Rights for 6 years.
Now, did you see the job ad for the Pride Foundation? Did someone tell you about it? How did this come about?
Well, when I was working at the Rhode Island Foundation, I actually knew of Pride Foundation before setting up and working within the foundation to set up, establish the fund, Equity Action. I looked across, you know, the landscape to see other models, to see who was doing what kind of work and what was going to be the right organization or structure for this fund in Rhode Island. And so I had been in touch with Pride Foundation, knew of its work, and actually sat on the National Board of Directors with my predecessor with the Funders for LGBTQ Issues. And so I was familiar with it, and when I went on to the National Center for Lesbian Rights, we did a good bit of work here in Seattle. So I can continue to build that those connections and that relationship. And so when Audrey Haberman, who had been the executive director for 13 years, had stepped aside, that I was informed of the opening and invited to take part in the application process.
And so,
and look at me.
And look at you. No, see, you're skipping steps, and that's why I want to get at it. Because we had Elizabeth Holford, the executive director of Equality Ohio, was on the show last week, and we were talking about that decision-making process, because I am calling you out right now, Chris Hermans. I think it was more than just look at me. I think there was a whole process in there.
There was, and it was an exhausting process. And I think anyone who's been a part of organizations and beloved organizations that have been, you know, are over 25 years old and that has had a long standing executive director in a critical moment in our community's history, that you have to be very deliberate to find a good match for the organization and where it's at. And so I absolutely commend Pride Foundation for the search process that they went through, and it was very helpful for me in understanding what the expectations were and also the vision and where the support was in place that, you know, that would allow the organization to thrive into the next decade.
Well, let's talk about that executive director role, because I'm quite fascinated by it, because as you just said, the organization has a vision, but so too do you. And so what is your process by which you meld those two things together?
That's a good question, Ken. I think, you know, you have to keep in mind my first day on the job when I arrived on January 3rd, 2012, included receiving a call from the governor's staff here in Washington State saying, you know, the governor is about to announce her support for marriage equality.
Right.
Can you be in Olympia tomorrow? And I was like, where's Olympia and how long does it take to get there? And so you have to keep in mind, I mean, that's immediately what I was walking into.
Wow.
And we then had an 11-month campaign that we were part of that we knew was going to change not only the landscape here in Washington State and the region, but would help change the landscape across the country. So in the short term, my vision was keep the doors open, make sure all of our, you know, basic functions continue to go forward, and how do we best add our expertise and our skills and our resources to both the public education campaign, which we ended up running for the Washington State marriage equality effort, and be a part of the political action committee so that we could ensure that we would really put our best foot forward and be able to capture the historic moment that we were given.
Nice.
For 2012, that really was what it was about. the benefit we've had since then is that the board and staff had really over the last 8 months, our conversation is perfectly timed. We have spent going through a strategic visioning process, and that's involved, you know, doing landscape kind of internal and external audit, looking at the opportunities and challenges ahead, and really figuring out what's the right place for us to focus our resources, knowing that we have an opportunity to really affect change. And if we were strategic, we could have an impact beyond what we could ever imagine. And so we actually, the board just approved our next 3-year strategic plan, and very excited. And that was a you know, as you mentioned earlier, a blending process of kind of what I get to see and what I have seen in terms of the national work, and also all of my travels across the Northwest, and being able to bring that to bear on our overarching plan.
Well, let's talk about the Northwest. Before we even get to the specific services and initiatives that Pride Foundation puts out there, we have to talk about the Northwest. So I looked this up. So we have Alaska, Idaho, Montana, Oregon, and Washington.
That's correct.
Did I miss any?
No, you did not.
Okay. Now, when I read the list, it was a little Sesame Street-ish of one of these things is not like the other. And to me, that was Washington, because it seems to me, and again, I've been to none of these places, but it seems to me that on the LGBT equality front, that Washington is in a bit of a different place than the other four.
That's correct, Ken. And first, let me not be rude any longer and invite you to come to the Northwest anytime. You know, it's, you know, I think what we have to keep in mind is that Washington State may look like it has, you know, achieved nirvana, and that we have most legal equality protections on the law, you know, on the books in terms of laws and regulations. But that doesn't necessarily translate into a change in people's lived experience, especially when you're talking about, which most people don't know because they think of Frazier and When Harry Met Sally, there's somewhat of a distorted view of Washington State being equated to Seattle, and it's not at all. I mean, Washington State is very diverse in terms of its geography, its industry, the culture, and it's very rural outside of the Puget Sound area. And so what you have, in fact, is almost a microcosm of the country within the state of Washington, and then we have a microcosm in terms of the region, because Alaska has no legal protections and Washington State has almost all. But it doesn't mean that there's not work to do, especially on changing heart and minds and really ensuring that the policies that are in place are actually implemented, and that there is actually ways for people to get remedies if, in fact, they're discriminated against.
Well, we have to talk about Montana, because as our listeners, loyal listeners, know, I'm a little bit obsessed with Montana, and I will tell you why, Chris. I did indeed write my sixth grade project on the treasure state of Montana, and I'm still convinced, although I can't locate it in my parents' house, that the governor wrote me a letter personally. That might be revisionist, I'm not sure.
Fantastic.
I know, right? And so you actually, as you just mentioned, you've toured around, you've been to these places, and I found this that you wrote when you first took on the position, and I love it. You wrote, quote, "My time in Montana made it vividly clear to me why I choose to do this work. It also reaffirmed for me why Pride Foundation is committed to being on the ground in each state, inspiring and joining with community partners and leaders, donors, funders, and volunteers across the Northwest in places where equality and fairness for LGBTQ people and families may be least expected or hardest to find." Tell me about that work on the ground there in Montana.
I'm glad you raised that. I was actually just in Missoula a couple weeks ago, and it was a reminder, again, about why I wrote that and what my reflections were on the first, you know, on the first visit. And you know this from your own work and your own life, that you know, you meet incredible, you know, incredibly humble people that don't necessarily see the risk and courage that they're demonstrating in their daily lives to be that big of a deal. And then when you see the circumstances around them, whether it's, you know, kind of there's no protections, people fear for their safety, people can be fired from their jobs or kicked out of their housing, and, you know, that you see people continue to persevere, hold hope, and welcome me into their homes and their community every time to say proudly, this is what we're doing. And, you know, there's like some really interesting cutting edge work going on in terms of thinking about how we bring equality to rural, more rural communities and rural states, especially around transgender healthcare access, around providing support for people living with HIV/AIDS in rural areas, especially around kind of the day-to-day supports and around prevention and outreach that no longer is funded through Ryan White.
Right.
And, you know, you just see that, and, you know, it's just amazing in terms of that people recognize that, you know, which we have since our inception, we recognize that individuals are powerful, but we are much stronger and much more effective when we do things together. And that's really our philosophy as we do this work, is really letting the local leaders really guide the work and have us be a partner with that, and really recognizing the incredible sacrifice and courage they have to be doing this work that really isn't easy, not very well supported, and, you know, is actually risky.
Yeah. Well, we have the abstract down. I am convinced, and I was already convinced, we have to continue fighting and we have to continuing establish services. But tell us, what does Pride Foundation provide?
We provide a number of things. We
yeah.
provide grant dollars. We provide scholarships and fellowships to emerging as well as established leaders, provide technical expertise and convenings. In many ways, what traditional community foundations do.
Yeah.
And what we really try to do is elevate the organizations and leaders who are doing the work on the ground, leverage resources and relationships to ensure that our movement, where we have opportunity and challenges, gets the investments that it needs to make the change, if it's both proactively pushing the needle around change or ensuring that any progress we've made, we can continue to defend.
Nice. Tell me about some of those moments. Give me some of those moments where you've been doing this work at Pride Foundation for the past year and a half, and you just said, oh my gosh, did I make the right decision?
Well, let me tell you, that the first day when I got the call from the governor's,
I bet.
The governor's office, and I'm thinking, because you have to keep in mind, Ken, I was at the National Center for Lesbian Rights during the No on A campaign, and I worked on the campaign. I
Look
was loaned to the campaign. So I already had that experience walking into this position. And so I think, you know, like everybody thought, you know, is this really the right moment, and can we do it? Because we have no choice, and we have to do it. We
right.
have to succeed here for the first time. And so I think I will not pretend that there wasn't almost, you know, on a daily basis up until maybe a week before the election where I thought, oh, my God, can we do this? But what I was reminded of, you know, when you spend time on campaigns, the heart-to-heart conversations you have, the sense of community and energy that you have trying to make history, no matter how sleep-deprived you are, you realize, you know, that being able to be a part of shaping history and that story is something that you rarely will you have a chance to do again. And so I, you know, all along the way, I was like, oh my gosh, this is perfect. This is fantastic. I wouldn't want to be anyplace else.
Nice.
You know, in the losses, you know, we lost an anti-discrimination ordinance in Alaska and Anchorage, which was devastating in both Helena and in Pocatello and Montana and mm-hmm. Idaho. There were non-discrimination ordinances up, and, you know, you still have the negative reactions and the fear-mongering that goes around LGBT people. And those are always hard moments, but you also realize the progress we've made, not, you know, the last few months, much less the last 5 years or the last 25 years. And you just say, there are many people who worked harder under much worse conditions to get us to this place, and we're all just kind of benefiting and reaping the rewards of all of that hard work that went unnoticed for so long.
But not to dwell too much on those setbacks, but I do, you know, it's one of my favorite topics to talk about in people in positions such as yours, just because when we have these setbacks, there are always two things happening at the same time. Obviously, it's a setback for the community, but because we are all so invested in LGBTQ equality and we're fighting for it on a personal level as well, you know, it's personally disappointing. As the executive director there, how do you motivate both yourself and your staff to work through it?
That's a great question. And I think, you know, I oftentimes recall back to my childhood days in rural Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and I think, you know, we've come a long way.
Right.
And, you know, having the opportunity to work in all the different communities in the context that I've worked in, I do have a real, you know, I have a good sense in terms of the arc of, you know, history and progress is not a straight line and is not like only steps forward.
Right.
And we do see that, that real change happens when, you know, people come together after setbacks or defeats. And that really is the hallmark, as we all learn from our parents, you know, it's not how you win, it's how you lose. And, you know, that you really step forward and think about, okay, what does this mean and what do we need to do differently? And oftentimes it's a wake-up call. It definitely was when we lost Prop 8 in California.
Right.
It's been a galvanizing tool here in the Northwest when we've looked at the losses around the non-discrimination ordinances in Alaska and Idaho and Montana. And so it's to say, okay, we learned things. What did we learn and what do we want to do differently? And it's really been a moment, which I'm thankful for, it's been a moment after those losses for people to say to themselves that we need to build a broader movement across borders and boundaries, across other movements and communities, and come together on a bigger vision for our country. And, you know, what they often say, it's, you know, this is the fight for the soul of our country. And, you know, there are a lot of people who have been energized by the way the LGBT equality movement has reached out and done its work the last couple of years. And I think we hold on to that and make sure that we continue to reach across a number of other movements in support of one another.
Nice. Well, one of the ways that we work through the disappointments and we celebrate the successes is with a staff. And you have, I've been looking through the page and reading everyone's bio. I will give you the floor to extol the virtues of your staff.
I, of course, oftentimes get the recognition, and it's the staff who does the hard work on
right.
the ground. And I would say that, again, you know, I was just blessed to be able to come in 20 months ago into an organization that had a longstanding history of success, accomplishment, and community respect across this region. And I've really just tried to continue to find ways to support the staff to think about how do we continue to do this work and do it in a strategic, impactful way in a very changing and ever-changing landscape. And the important part of what we were able to do 3 years ago was to put full-time staff on the ground in all five states, which prior to 2010 we hadn't done.
Right.
And what it meant is that I have long-standing residents who either grew up or went to school in and have been a part of the community for a long time, that immediately has the relationships and the credibility to be able to be the eyes and ears for us in terms of the way that we should show up and invest in LGBT equality. And what's remarkable is, especially if you look at states like Alaska, Idaho, and Montana, there is no LGBT-specific or LGBT-focused organization
mm-hmm.
that has paid staff. So, you know, everything there is either all volunteer run, or much of the services that we're talking about and that we invest in our grants is through mainstream providers.
And I will say this, you know, look, this is what I study. I have a PhD in leadership studies, but I think that you guys have the key distinguishing feature that all organizations need, and that is, of course, a canine unit.
That's true, and it continues to grow. I don't think our website, Ken, has actually the full picture. We are now up to, three dogs on a daily basis, and there are two other dogs that come on in a regular basis as well. So, yes, we do. We have canine mascots, and it's only fitting since Seattle has one of the highest per capita dog ownership rates in the country.
Seriously?
So, yes. Yes, you would pick that up very quickly when you came to visit Ken.
Now, I have to ask you, that's about your staff. What would your staff say if I called them about you?
Actually, I would rather not have you make that call. I would say this. What's happened in the Northwest, what's happened with Pride Foundation, is no different than what's been happening across the country
mm-hmm.
the last year, and that is it is a fast-changing landscape that everyone is constantly reassessing. What's the strategy? Where's the investment? How are we relevant? Where do we have an impact? How are we most strategic in terms of taking advantage of the opportunities we can't even anticipate?
Right.
So I would hope that my staff and my board, who, you know, I have definitely the best board of directors of any nonprofit organization, I would hope that they have said that over the last 22 months, that I have put the strategy and systems in place and supported our organization to be able to actually position ourselves to take advantage of those opportunities, to meet those challenges in this ever-changing landscape, and do it in a strategic way, in a respectful way, as a partner in the community on the ground, to have the greatest impact and to continue to ensure that we accelerate the pace of change for LGBT equality.
Well, give a shout out to our listeners in the Northwest and, of course, all over the place who are thinking, oh, gosh, I have listened to what Chris has to say. I want to support more the Pride Foundation. How can folks get involved?
Great. A number of ways. One is we would love for you to sign up to get our regular e-news and visit us on Facebook and Twitter and make sure that you share the information that you like and that you've read and you heard about. Of course, we, not unlike most LGBT-focused organizations, you know, we're an under-resourced movement,
mm-hmm.
and any ways that that people can either give of their time or their talent or their financial support, we're very welcoming and would appreciate that. And more than anything, we just ask people to live authentic lives and be very, you know, as bold as you can about sharing the stories about your life and what's important to you as LGBTQ people and allies, so that, in fact, we continue to shape public awareness and public opinion about why our being able to live fully protected with dignity is so important.
Nice. And tell everyone where they should go online to find you.
And they should go. It's very easy to remember. pridefoundation.org.
I would have assumed that had been taken already by another organization, but you guys have been around forever.
Yes, 28 years, going, you know, heading into our 30th.
Love it. Now, I did allude to it, or actually you alluded to it at the start. We should tell everyone that you are the majority owner of the Green Bay Packers.
No, I'm not the majority owner, but I'm one of, you know, I own a share, which is, you know, which most people do not understand that of the four major professional leagues, sports leagues, that the Green Bay Packers is the only team that is owned by the public, and so I own one share.
I like the idea that you are the majority shareholder.
I like that idea, too. Maybe we should make that happen, Ken.
No, because the only thing I'm thinking right now is go Badgers.
Well, you know what, and your mom would be very proud that you ended with that because, you know, and, you know, you'd be really down if you said go Bucky and then go Badgers.
I don't even know what that means, but I'm trying.
Bucky is the mascot's name.
I had no idea.
Yes.
But how is that going to help me win the pool? That's the important thing, Chris.
Well, because oftentimes, you know, you have to get down to the final criteria, like what that final decision is, and it's, do you like the mascot, and can the mascot win, you know, a head-to-head battle?
You know, the problem is that's the criteria I start with, Chris. That's the problem.
Oh, I thought that was the outfit and the colors.
I know. I have to tell you that when you were telling that whole story about how they called you and they were sending you to Olympia, and I would imagine that one of your questions had to have been, oh, my God, what am I going to wear?
Yes, it often is the case. But you have to remember, Seattle is rainy and cool almost all the time, so you adapt very quickly.
Oh, man. Well, look, what you guys are doing over the Pride Foundation is just incredible. Sure, you are providing invaluable resources, but you just said it. You are in this process of providing a place for people to express their voices, and you guys are collecting their stories, and you are connecting people who so desperately want to be connected. And the services are again incredible, and you are supporting our march towards equality, but you are also providing that opportunity for human to human contact, and I can think of nothing better out there.
Well, thank you, Ken. It means a lot. And really, what's important for us is that people feel like they can be who they are, where they are, and love the person that they're in love with. And, you know, we never want people to feel like they have to leave their hometowns, their communities, their families in order to be genuine and safe. And so it's, you know, we're all privileged to do this work and very much appreciate you're allowing us to share our story of the Northwest with all of your listeners.
I got to get out there.
Yes, you do. You know that it's an open standing invitation.
Needless to say, tons more for us to talk about, Chris. We must
Absolutely.
Have you back in the future.
Well, I would welcome that, Ken. Thank you again for inviting me to be a part of the show.
Thanks, Chris.
Okay, take care.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we have another amazing guest for you on this week's show. Dr. Deborah Plummer is a nationally recognized psychologist and diversity solutions thought leader. She is editor of the Handbook of Diversity Management, the award-winning author of Racing Across the Lines, Changing Race Relations Through Friendships. In addition, she created the Sister Nun Cozy Mysteries, which includes They Call Me Sister and The Family That Stays Together, which I've been reading all weekend. Deborah is a regularly featured blogger for the Huffington Post and commentator for numerous media outlets. And now she is here with us. Deborah, welcome to this show with So Gay.
Thank you so much. So good to be on your show.
Tell me, we can't go any further than you telling me, what is a thought leader? I want to be one.
You most likely are. Anyone, I think a thought leader is one who looks at new ways of knowing and new ways of experiencing something that is in our, you know, common ground, I think. And so a thought leader would be, you know, anyone who can put a different twist to maybe an old idea,
okay,
or help people to understand something that was a little bit complicated.
Now, is there a polite term for the opposite of a thought leader?
I think that would be in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Disorders.
So we keep those to ourselves. Very good, Deborah.
Exactly.
Very good. Well,
exactly.
We have to start out with a little Deborah Plummer, This Is Your Life, because I just learned about a second ago that you're an Ohioan. Do you consider yourself to be an Ohioan? Is that
Look at that. I do. I was born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio, went to school there, worked there, et cetera. You know, when I came here at the young old age to the Boston area, people said to me, "You're moving now? Why? At your age?" I definitely, you know, and I love Cleveland, actually. I love the Cleveland area. I actually like many things more about Massachusetts in terms of its, you know, its politics, et cetera, but I do love Cleveland.
Now, before we even get, we have to talk about race, we have to talk about religion, we have a ton to talk about, but you have the inside track. How do I get them to accept me here as a Clevelander?
I think, you know, Clevelanders are basically, I find them, you know, just very friendly, and also I think it's easy to penetrate, particularly if you go to, I would go to the restaurants, hang out downtown, hang out in the uptown now,
yeah,
you know, University Circle area, real cool area. I think it's a fabulous place. There's just so much, you know, going on in Cleveland, and I wish Clevelanders really had great pride in the city as much as some of the people I experienced here. If I always said, boy, if they had a tenth of what the pride that sometimes they find in these cities, which I find somewhat lacking compared to Cleveland. Cleveland is such a great place.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. I probably should stop calling them Flatlanders, but other than that, I really like it here. Totally fine. All right, we have a ton to talk about. Are you ready?
I am.
All right. Well, we have to go to that piece of your bio that I know so many folks start with, but you're in high school, apparently in the Cleveland area, very exciting. You're in high school, and you're going, I'm sure, more than just going through the motions, and you're deciding, what should I do after high school? And tell everyone, because I didn't put it in your bio because I wanted you to say it, where did you land, Deborah?
I actually landed in a convent.
Look,
and that's
that.
Not a made-up story. I was there for 13 years.
It's not even a metaphor.
No, it really isn't. In fact, I have a sister who actually is the inspiration for the one character in the Cozy Mysteries, Tina, who's very gregarious and just very out there, the complete opposite of a nun. And when I was in the convent, and she would always tell people, I have a sister that is a nun, and they would just start cracking up. They would just laugh, and they said, no, you're kidding. They say, no, I really do. And then she would call me, and she would say, Sister Nun, you know, tell them you're a nun. And that's how the nickname even came, because they used to call me Sister Nun.
Well, I have to tell you, I mean, I'm a gay Jew from New Jersey, so my knowledge of nuns is limited. One could argue it's limited. How would you even describe the convent to people?
Well, you know, at the time, in the late 60s, early 70s, you know, through the 70s, it was pretty much the hippie movement. And if you had any ideas about wanting to change the world for a better place, make a difference, there were a lot of, I think, strong influences, particularly for women.
Yeah.
Particularly women who grew up in a whole Catholic environment. I could either be a teacher, a nurse, or a nun. You know, those were my options. You know, my mother kept telling me that that's what she thought I was going down the path of, the hippie. But, you know, I think I wanted a little bit more security, into the life security. So one of the nuns when I was in the convent, you know, I actually decided I was going into the Peace Corps. And then she said, why don't you go all the way, which I find rather hysterical now that I interpret it to mean the convent, like give my life totally to God rather than some of the other ways that could be interpreted. I was, you know, a good Catholic girl and still very much, you know, I always say I'm Catholic by culture and by ritual, but not so much by doctrine. But, you know, that's another whole story. But it was a influential time in my life, and many of my good friends from high school actually were entering the convent at the time, so it just seemed like a very natural thing to do, despite the fact that I was black, though, because, you know, there aren't too many African-American nuns in the world.
Right. Well, tell me about that moment. So your mom thinks you're going to be a hippie, and you detoured in another direction. Did it catch her by surprise? Was she well-prepared?
It was very much a surprise, because we went for the information kind of interview. And I think her and my dad were very united in the fact that because I was only 17, that they weren't going to allow this to happen. But then my dad had one question. He asked who would be paying for my college education. And the nun said that the convent would, you know, the religious order would take care of that. And so that was a done deal for my dad.
Nice.
And so my mom was real upset, but he said, you know, she can go, you know. And I remember the ride back home, because my mom was saying any of my other daughters, but not her, because this one will stick it out. You know, if it's Chris or the other ones, they'll leave, you know. And my dad's thing was like, hey, they're paying for college and, you know, and she's going to get good, and she can leave if she needs to. And it wasn't in my mind to leave at all, you know, because at that time you really, you know, took that very seriously, you know, final vows, et cetera. So, you know, I thought I would die in the habit.
Yeah. I have it in my mind that when your dad got the answer to his question, he just looked up and said, praise God. And that was it.
Exactly.
I want to talk about nuns a little bit, because you wrote this. You have so many pieces in the Huffington Post, and it's just great, because there's a degree to which, Deborah, I don't even need you on the show. I could just read all your stuff and just pretend that you're here, but it's great to get your take on it. You wrote, having done the lion's share of the social work long before social service agencies took notice, women religious across the United States have been the catalyst for government taking responsibility for the social needs of millions of people. And I don't know if maybe I'm more clued in now, because I am obsessed with the nuns on the bus. I think that they are oh my God, I think they're the greatest.
Absolutely. Same here.
But the American nuns, as they stand right now, it's a bit of a struggle.
Right. It really is, because they're, you know, it's divided. There's those that are, you know, the more conservative, that are tied to Rome, and more of a traditional Catholic knowledge, and then there's those who really experience, like the nuns on the bus, you know, their faith and the gospel values as the driver, so that they still remain true to the gospel, they remain true to their faith traditions, but the, what they're after is, you know, justice. Social justice leads it. So I think they're forging ahead on areas like immigration and healthcare, the way that, you know, centuries ago for the homeless and poverty and, you know, like I said, many of the issues that were taken up by the government that we now look to for support for those who are disadvantaged, you know, the nuns were doing that work. So I think we'll see the same push that the some of the contemporary nuns are doing, like the nuns on the bus. I think that that's wonderful.
Yeah. Oh, it's amazing. Tell us more generally, before we start getting into some specific issues, why does talking about diversity, talking about social justice, why does that motivate you, do you think?
You know, I think because I grew up African-American in inner city, Catholic and not Baptist or Protestant faith like most of the African-Americans. My parents were also, my mom was from Panama, my father was from Jamaica. So I had a very different American experience. And, you know, we grew up lower middle class. My mother had a marvelous way of robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I grew up with a lot of white folks, because growing up Catholic, you know, and the white folks were in our house, and, you know, just a great diversity. So I always was curious on why that was so and the impact that it had. So, because for me, it was such a positive experience. And I, at a very early age, experienced the benefits of diversity that I think most people did not. And so I've just been on a lifelong, you know, journey in terms of professionals long before. I mean, and I'm talking race, sexual orientation,
yeah.
Age differences. My parents gave us, they were great role models on that, I must say.
These different places, I was looking at your website, there are so many different organizations and universities and folks who say, Dr. Plummer, we want you to come out here. There's some work to do. What goals are folks looking for when they say, get out here, we need your help?
Yeah, and that's a good question, because I think at the very beginning when, you know, folks are, there's mostly awareness and, you know, just the basic issues of having people be civil in the workplace and not get sued.
Right.
You know, that was out the gate, that's what they were now.
It's practical.
Now at the other, yeah, exactly. Because, you know, when I first started doing this work, I said I wasn't going to do any organization that was being fueled by a lawsuit. You know, I had wanted them to be really, this had to be one of their organizational values, and I would have worked. You know, I think I could probably count on one hand and a room for two or three at the beginning that didn't have a lawsuit pending or, you know, pushing them as a driver. So
right.
I do believe that the law does serve that purpose of acting as a catalyst for us to get us in the direction we need to go. Now I find that, you know, most organizations are beyond the compliance. The really progressive organizations are really looking at differences. They're really looking at how they can leverage those differences to make a fundamental difference in how people do business.
Yeah.
And a fundamental difference on how the organization moves, meets their business objectives or their mission objectives, and how that diversity can really lead to innovation and creativity and productivity and then just enhance everything. So.
And how about that word diversity? So, you know, look, this is what I teach. I tell my listeners week in and week out, this is what I teach on a college campus. These are the courses I teach. And I struggle sometimes with really initiating these conversations about diversity, because it's become such a code word and so many folks not willing to put in the work. And it actually is work. In fact, you wrote this in one of your Huffington Post pieces on the idea of post-race. You wrote, quote, a post-racial society is more like a continuous improvement process that requires incremental improvements over time rather than a breakthrough improvement that happens all at once as a result of a Black American as president. I feel like even when I'm out there, even when I'm in class, everyone's just looking for that breakthrough, that easy fix of, okay, here's our watershed moment and we're all good now.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I think that people want that because they think of it as an issue just of respect. And I think then people they really do believe themselves to be culturally sensitive and having that basic and obvious respect for human differences. And I do believe that we have come a long way with that.
Certainly.
But it's the area, as you probably know, cultural competence. How do we navigate our increasingly multicultural, multiracial, just very, very diverse global society? And that requires skills that take work. And so I don't think people want to do the work.
No. And I think the folks who don't want to do the work are the ones who are just saying, oh, yeah, I'm colorblind. I don't see it. That's actually not possible. Thank you.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you've written on so many different topics, and we have to hit some of them. You wrote about the Boy Scouts. What prompted you to write a piece about the Boy Scouts?
I think there was a personal piece around that. First of all, listening to the news, media, and then just, thinking that, this organization had such great influence over our youth, especially our young men. And, I was a Girl Scout. But then I have some very close friends who, they're married, and he and his husband, well, Sam in Massachusetts, so that's possible.
Yeah.
So they have a little boy, and they would want him to be, he wanted to be in part of the, the Boy Scouts in school. And yet, it was knowing that those, not so much at their local.
The local chapters,
local club or whatever you call those. That it would have been, it would not have been possible for their son to be able to go to get the fullness or to, to reach the full benefits of the Boy Scouts just because, their parents were gay or they couldn't be involved in it. And just, and the message that it sent to their son, I just felt that there was a personal driver, but just in my own thinking, thinking through in terms of the logic, it didn't make sense.
Yeah.
It just didn't make sense there.
And you posed a couple questions there. You posed the question, it is presumed that allowing gay adult leaders would prevent a morally enriching experience for Boy Scouts. Does that mean that whenever gay adults are in leadership positions, we are subject to an immoral experience? And I would imagine, given your background, you've given some time to think about morals and morality and the intersections of morality and society.
Absolutely. I've taught theology. I'm still like that, that part. I still believe that a spiritual base is what drives us in terms of diversity. And I'm not necessarily mean, for some people, the spiritual is attached to a religion, an organized religion.
Right.
But I do truly believe that, if you follow someone's logic, which is what I was trying to do with the Boy Scouts, thinking to its logical consequences, it falls apart. It just doesn't make sense.
Right.
It just doesn't make sense,
So what do you do when you see some of these counter arguments being rooted, at least in words, in religion? I would imagine that irks you a little.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God, Jeff. It does, because I, besides it not being, I don't think, just logical, I think it doesn't express, a God or a concept of God or a concept of the gospel values if you're Christian or any other, any world, take any religion, and the commonality between them in terms of what we believe about the nature of people and what an even a good moral behavior is about. It just defies when you are exclusive of part of God's creation. It just doesn't make sense to me. And I think then there's a psychologist part that I put on as a psychologist hat, and knowing and experiencing and having studied what is development, and development in the human, the science of human behavior, how it just doesn't jive when you put those two together. And so for many people, religion represents the rules, or it represents a boundary, a strict boundary that I think when you're really spiritual, it doesn't have those boundaries.
Yeah.
It just doesn't.
I have to say, just backing up a step, I would not want to engage in a debate with you, because I would start with, well, religiously, and you would say, no, I have that covered. And then I would say, well, psychologically, nope, got that one too. So I don't really know which direction I would go to be a fellow thought leader. Now, you wrote about one of my favorite topics. So we had the whole, let's just call it a snafu because we're a few months past it, during the Super Bowl of Roland Martin saying some really just silly things. I mean, easily interpreted as homophobic, but just not a lot of thought put into it. And then we get to the fun part of when our well-known celebrities or people in the media say something homophobic or do something anti-gay, then they do their apology. And the apology is rarely satisfying. And you wrote, intentions do not mitigate impact, but explaining our intentions and apologizing do increase understanding and create a civil and respectful society. And I want to give you the chance to parse that out more. What apologies are actually satisfying?
That's a very good question, because I do think we are quick to media or the PR control folks.
Oh, yeah.
When people make these things, come out really quick and they apologize and they say the socially responsible thing.
Right.
But I think the apologies that are really, when we talk about intention and impact in the communication process, the ones that really do help to lessen the impact is when somebody says, hey, you know what? I wasn't thinking, or this is what my intentions were. And you know what? Now that I know that they're pretty messed up, or, you know, I was limiting my thinking, or I have a long way to go, or this is when I unbundle it, this is where I was coming from, and,
yeah.
You know, and I know that I've got to do some more work on this. But most of all, the fact that my words or what I did, you know, had this impact on you, and being able to name what the impact was, not that just, you know, not the kind of half apology, of which I don't think is an apology at all. Say,
exactly.
It hurt you in any way, or, you know.
I'm sorry you heard it that way.
To you.
Yeah.
You know, that's not an apology. You have to be able to say, you know, recognize the multiple realities in a situation. It may have not been my reality, but I'm not going to dismiss yours, and I'm certainly going to honor yours. And I think that that's a respectful and a true apology, and say, see, I'm going to keep working on this.
Yeah, nice. Well, we have to talk about your writing as of late, because you've been writing fiction, and it's very, I have to tell you, I grew up watching the Father Dowling mysteries, so I enjoy a good nun mystery. Tell me what prompted you to say, I need to devote more of my life to fiction.
And again, you know, that's a great question. I have been an academic, so as you know,
yeah.
As a fellow academic, you're researching, writing, you're studying, and everything has to be, there has to be a citation, or it has to be, grounded in theory, and it really has to, have just great heuristics, you know, and
yeah.
Mental sets and all that kind of stuff. And so I have had a good long career on that, and I've enjoyed that, and I still do a lot of that writing, but at the same time, I enjoy writing the art of writing, but I also didn't want to have to cite everything or have a footnote for everything that I put down on paper. And a good friend of mine who actually is an attorney writes, she wrote fiction on the side, and
mm-hmm.
She was writing erotica. I didn't realize it was that, you know, but she encouraged me to write fiction. And so I found that was a great catharsis just to make things up.
Yeah.
And then I just drew from my life experience, particularly because even when I was reading, writing nonfiction, when I wrote Racing Across the Lines, no matter how much research I did about the book, the fact that people found most fascinating was the fact that I was a former nun. So they would always want me to talk about that rather than my research. So I thought, why don't I make stuff up about a nun and the convent? And, you know, I landed in the mystery genre. So
look at that.
That's how it all began.
Love it. Now, you have all of these tips for writers, which it's so great seeing, you know, I have all my pieces on the Huffington Post, and I never can predict which ones are going to be well-read, and it always just amazes me.
Same thing. Absolutely.
So you put out these pieces on tips for writers, and holy cow, did those blow up, because everybody's looking for tips. Give us a couple, but don't give all of them to us, because we want people to go read your Huffington Post pieces. But give us a couple really important tips for our emerging writers.
You know, I think, you know, one of the ways in which I've learned to write, besides for, you know, the formal ways, are just from reading. I think the more you read, and if you pick up the style, like I just finished some works from Tom Perata, Mm-hmm. And he is excellent in showing us and not telling us.
Yeah.
The story. So I think that that's part of the writing piece, is showing people, not just giving them like a diary, like I did this, or the character did this and character did that. That showing, that not telling, it seems like a very easy tip and a very easy way to write, but it's not.
Yeah. And I love, you even put on your Facebook page, I love the idea, not the idea, just the fact that, that people who read just have a better self-image. So everybody should be reading more.
Exactly.
Love it.
Exactly.
Love it. So what are you working on now? What are we looking forward to?
We're looking forward to, actually, I'm working, this is a nonfiction piece, actually, on friendship patterns. Again, I've been curious about friendship and how it changes race relations, but more particularly how it makes you smarter. So how friends that cross racial lines, friends from, you know, different backgrounds, who don't share your same professional identity, who don't share the same race, gender, et cetera, actually helps to make you smarter. So I just completed some data collection on a friendship survey. And actually, if people want to keep going to get the friendship survey, I'm trying to get those numbers up as well. And looking at people's friendships patterns, and then I'll do some writing about that. I'm not sure if it's going to be a magazine article or a full book, but it will be something that I'll, that part I'm trying to write out. And then there's the third installment of the Sister Nun Mysteries, where Kathy and Tina will find some way to get in trouble and find something out that they have to bring to light for, you know, the whole world to know without breaking confidentiality. So I'll work on that too.
I'm laughing because I can see the pattern. You're writing, you're like, oh, I'm doing APA, citation. I need another mystery.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's a total pattern. Now tell everyone where they can go to learn more about all the cool things that you're doing.
I think probably it will either be just dlplummer.com. That's probably the easiest, and that can take you the link to the books, to the writing. Or please like me, Deborah Plummer Bussey. I use that my married name as well for my writing. So Bussey. Deborah Plummer, liking that Facebook page, I'd really appreciate that.
Nice. Well, like I said, we have so much more to talk about because we didn't even get to, you have a great piece on when you went back and read some of your papers from when you were studying to go more into the field of psychology. And oh my gosh, do I want to talk about weight? And I very much want to talk about race relations in particular in the gay community, which I think struggles with it enormously, which is all to say, can we get you back?
Absolutely.
All right.
Oh, this has been a great conversation, Ken. I would love to come back.
Well, Deborah Plummer, I am going to work my darndest to become a thought leader until you come back on our show next, and then we're gonna compare notes.
You already are.
All right, we'll see.
You already are. Declare it. Claim it.
We'll claim it. Claim it and own it. Deborah, what an absolute treat to have you on the show. Talk about using your voice in just an amazing way. You keep on writing. You alternate between your citations and your mysteries, and we're going to have you back to talk about so much more in the near future.
Thank you so much.
Folks, that's really all we have time for this week's episode. So I bid you adieu. Get out there. Go do some incredible things. Try to make a difference by using your voice the way you know how to use it, to bring forth the voices of your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And of course, while you're out there making a difference, remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?